Welcome to Discovery and Inspiration, a podcast from the National Humanities Center. I'm Meredith Graham, Associate Director of Education Programs, and your host for this episode. Our guest today, Naomi Andre, is working to tell a more comprehensive and inclusive story of opera by constructing a history of Blackness in opera from the 19th century to the present. Naomi is David G. Fry, Distinguished Professor in Music at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She is a founding member of the Black Opera Research Network and served as the inaugural scholar in residence for the Seattle Opera. This year, as a fellow at the center, Naomi is working on a book tentatively titled Writing Opera, Singing Blackness in the United States. Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you so much for that warm introduction. It's a pleasure to be here.
Please tell our audience a little bit about what the contemporary opera world looks like and sounds like. So who are the audiences today and what are American opera houses performing?
Opera audiences today are so much more diverse than when I first started going in the mid-1980s when I was in college. I was an unusual person in the audience as a young African-American woman who didn't come from a really moneyed background. My mother sang in churches, and I loved classical music, and I had piano lessons. But the opera audience seemed to be people who went thinking of opera as a deep passion, but also something that was kind of a spectacle kept at an arm's length. There would be deep passions involved. However, what is unusual about opera happening now, and I would say since the new millennium, it seems, but especially in these past 10, 15 years, we're seeing more and more variety in who goes to the opera, who's writing operas that are getting performed, and just sort of what happens at the opera house. The opera house has become a bigger space of inclusion, which I'm loving.
So in your 2018 book, Black Opera, History, Power, Engagement, you open with a discussion of engaged opera that you describe as an approach that brings together opera and historical context and focuses on how it resonates in the present day. Do you mind telling us a bit more about this and the analytical approaches that you're taking in your new book?
Oh, sure. In Black Opera, I have the Black Shadow Culture, which looks at opera happening simultaneously, but in the shadows as the mainstream white opera culture. And this is because pretty much before 1955, when Marian Anderson sang at the Metropolitan Opera, Black folks rarely, if ever, she wasn't the very first person to sing on any opera stage, but certainly was the first in a major role at the Metropolitan Opera, and that opened the doors for other folks. The Black Shadow opera culture is saying that opera has been happening, and I've been really surprised and happy to find out, back to the 19th century. I look at singers, composers, and impresarios, people who were putting opera on. Theodore Drury is someone, and Kristen Turner's work has showed us a lot about that. Mary Caldwell Dawson's work, and there's an opera about that with Sandra Seton as the playwright and Carlos Simon as the composer, and Denise Graves sang it's the Passion of Mary Caldwell Dawson. Glimmerglass Opera sponsored that. We're getting opera that is happening on the stage. I like the example of the Passion of Mary Caldwell Dawson because we've got somebody who, a Black composer, a Black playwright, and a Black singer. Glimmerglass Opera has been really supportive of operas about different things. And it's about this impresario, Mary Caldwell Dawson, who went to the New England Conservatory, realized as a Black woman she probably wasn't going to be getting a lot of professional mainstream situations. So she founded the National Negro Opera Company and ran it out of her home and different places. So this is a nice microcosm of opera now that's happening and exposing, bringing out the past that I had no idea about.
In Black Opera, you also included a section on political action and social justice as it relates to engaged musicology. So what is your advice to younger scholars on how they can incorporate this type of culturally engaged writing into their own work?
I'm so glad you brought that up because I had mentioned there were two things I did in Black Opera. One is the shadow culture. The other is a rubric for thinking about opera and how basically, very selfishly, I thought about myself and the opera audience and what I was seeing and what I was not seeing. So this rubric, and this is something I set out there that other people can take up, is who is writing the opera? While we're looking at the regular analytical frame of the first performance, the musical analysis, the historical context, everything that went into it, which is what a lot of people look at for opera, I'm saying, why don't we focus on three things? Who are the production team, the composer, the librettist, the people who write the words, and the director? And are we having people representing themselves? Are we telling different stories? And both of those are good, but it brings a certain understanding to what's happening in the compositional history. The second rubric is, who do we see embodying the roles on stage? In the case of opera, one of the questions is, are we using blackface for Otello and Aida? Are we using yellowface for Puccini's Madama Butterfly and Turandot? So who is embodying these roles? And the third thing is, who are we in the audience? And who are we as writers? And that's something where, as I'm looking at this, and I was noticing from the 80s and the 90s into the 2000s, that people would blacken up for certain roles, like Aida and Otello. And it made me a little uncomfortable, because blackface is not something that happens, at least in mainstream culture, such as Broadway, movies, TV. Even most high schools now don't use that type of makeup. With opera, the idea of having not true-to-color casting is something that I think can be wonderful. I love to see people of color in all types of roles. And hence, I also think that white people can sing Aida and Otello. If you've got that voice, and it's a rare voice that can sing these, I want to hear you as somebody who loves opera. So beginning to have these conversations and discussions about who can sing opera.
So whose stories are you most excited to tell in your current project?
Well, in this project, rather than focusing on just a couple of operas, Black Opera, I had a few case studies with Porgy and Bess, Carmen, Winnie the Opera, an opera that was happening in South Africa that I got to see the premiere in 2010. I was really pleased, surprised, excited to find out that South Africa, in the first generation after the dismantling of apartheid, which happened in 1994, that there were operas being written and performed and sung by Black and mixed-race South Africans. This was something absolutely not allowed during apartheid. So when I found out that was happening, I thought, wow, look at them. They're leading the way. And to have an opera about Winnie Madikizela Mandela, I thought, isn't that incredible? She was in the audience at the premiere. And it was an amazing social moment full of social justice, political importance, when they invited her up afterwards and she said, Amandla, and raised her fist, and the whole audience said, Ingawethu. It's like this response. So the opera house immediately was transformed into this type of not just something from the past, but something that was happening and alive and vibrant right then.
Please tell us a bit more about your public musicology work. I know you have testified at the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution hearing on Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina's legislation that would designate the song Lift Every Voice and Sing, written by the Johnson Brothers in 1900, as a national hymn. This year, you were also a scholar in residence at the Seattle Opera, where you advise staff and leadership on matters of race and gender in opera, consult in artistic planning as it relates to representation of race and gender, and participate in company panel discussions. What does this type of work mean to you, and how do you prioritize it?
This comes out of what I've been thinking about with engaged musicology. When I took this different view of opera, not just what is historically there, but who's on stage, who's behind the scenes, and who's writing about it, it made me feel excited about opera is really something that's living and breathing today. And writing about that, I was very happily surprised, even somewhat shocked, when opera companies started asking me to be involved with panels and conversations. My name was out there. Somehow the team behind Representative Clyburn found me, and as a musicologist, I was able to talk about the history of a hymn and how that's a song of praise, and it comes from both the Roman Catholic liturgy, Jewish liturgy, Byzantine backgrounds. It's an ancient form that seems to encompass so beautifully what Lift Every Voice and Sing has become for the United States, not just African Americans, but we see this in so many different venues now. And it seems to be a hymn of belonging for, you know, lift every voice and sing for this world we're living in, this community. So this engaged musicology, public musicology, reaching out, I've been so fortunate that people have come to me. I've been thrilled that a bunch of things seem to be coming together, both in the 2010s and then especially after, I think, 2020, where that summer when everybody was pretty much at home during the pandemic and we saw and witnessed so many different things that had been happening around George Floyd, around the Me Too movement, around Black lives, queer lives. It's just, we were at a moment where we could think about stuff. And a lot of people said, in opera companies, as well as in other classical music venues, ballet and symphonies, our audiences are not finding us as relevant as we are. And reaching out to scholars seems to be a new movement, and I'm really loving it. I have worked with Seattle Opera since 2019, and really, I love the work I do there. I'm learning so much, and they're a company that's really ready to have conversations about representation, about keeping their base and expanding it to be more inclusive.
What do some of those conversations look like?
Well, one thing I was really impressed with was they asked me to moderate a conversation on Bizet's Carmen that they were going to be performing. And they called it, they asked me to jump in. They had wonderful people on their team who organized this decolonizing allure. And they had me as a moderator. They had another professor who looked at the Texas, Mexico, mariachi, mestiza, really rich music world. And they had three female artists of color. There was a theatrical person, a Korean woman. I'm sorry, I can't remember their names. They were local in Seattle. And then two African-American visual artists. There was a community conversation. I talked a little bit about Bizet and Carmen. And then we talked about women and representation and the arts and different voices today. And it was the most inventive, wonderful thing. So when they said, we'd like to continue and formalize this relationship with you. And I thought, I'm a scholar. What does that mean? You know, I'm a professor. And we came up with a scholar in residence. And I go out there three times for residencies. In fact, I'm heading out tomorrow morning. It is a really exciting event. I'll be speaking with a woman on a Black host local television show. I will be giving two Verdi seminars to people who are able to come and signed up, sort of continuing education. I wrote my dissertation on Verdi. But it's looking at staging difference. We'll be looking at Verdi and Spanish themes in some of his operas, and we'll be looking at Verdi and Blackness. And so it's inventive, creative. It helps subscribers, and whether they're seasoned opera goers or newer folks to opera, get a deeper dive into understanding who Giuseppe Verdi was, why his works are so important in the second half of the 19th century, and how with very popular works, he's always bringing in these themes of difference in representation from Trovatore, which is set in 14th century Aragon, or Ulrika in Umbalo and Mascara, where she is, there are different settings, but sort of a different, she's a fortune teller, and in the setting based in Boston, she's called a Creole. There's Verdi's Aida, Verdi's Otello. So Verdi is a master of drama and was always interested in different stories to intensify the emotions. So this is giving a different view that people haven't normally thought that much about with Verdi's operas.
For our last question, I want to know, what operas are you excited about right now, and who are the composers and musicians that you're most interested in right now?
Well, I came to the center to write about bringing up to the present were three incredible operas that premiered the summer of 2019, right before the pandemic. It was Fire Shut Up in My Bones by Terrence Blanchard that Opera Theatre St. Louis produced, commissioned and produced, and that's an opera that then has become very well known because it was the first opera the Met did by a Black composer that opened their season after the pandemic in September of 2021. There was Anthony Davis's The Central Park Five that premiered at Long Beach Opera in 2019, and that went on to be the first opera by a Black composer to win the Pulitzer Prize in music. And then there was Blue, an opera by Janine Tesori and Tazewell Thompson that was premiered at Glimmerglass Opera in the summer of 2019. And so I was thinking, okay, that's a wonderful project. It brings us up to 2019. However, there are more works that are happening. So I'm really excited about those three operas. If you can see them, definitely do go to see them. And they're getting performed more. And there's a DVD of Fire Shut Up in My Bones with the Metropolitan Opera production. And I wrote the essay for that. There's a CD recording of Blue. And I wrote the CD notes for that. And then Anthony Davis's X, Life and Times of Malcolm X, which was his first opera from 1986, is getting performed in more and more places. So that's really exciting. Three operas to look out for, because these are operas I'm now going to be adding to this book project. I thought I could close the door in 2019. One is The Factotum, which is by Will Liverman and DJ King Rico, two friends. Both started as singers. Will Liverman has gone on to become one of this generation's most promising baritones. And here he sings in the opera, but he also is one of the co-composers with King Rico, DJ King Rico. And this is, just very quickly, Will Liverman is a lyric baritone who was singing Rossini's Barber of Seville. He says you go on a gig and you have got to get your hair done. He's sitting in a Black barbershop and said, we need to set Barber of Seville, as an inspiration for in a Black barbershop. And so that's Factotum. Omar is the other one, which is local here in North Carolina. It was co-commissioned by Spoleto in South Carolina and Carolina Performing Arts here in North Carolina. Rhiannon Giddens is a composer, also wrote the libretto, and Michael Abels is also a co-composer with that. And Omar was a Muslim cleric who was enslaved and brought here in 1806. And he was brought to Charleston and then escaped to Fayetteville. And so the Carolinas were important in his world. And the third opera is coming in 2025, and it is Loving versus State of Virginia. I don't know what the full title is, but it's based on that 1967 Supreme Court case that allowed for Black and white marriages to happen. So that's being written by Damien Jeter, and Jessica Murphy Moo is the librettist, and it is Virginia Opera and Virginia Symphony are co-commissioning it. So history, emotions, feelings, stories, all of this is coming out on the stage. It's really exciting.
Well, thank you, Naomi, and thank you to everyone who has joined us for this discussion. Please tune in to our next episode of Discovering Inspiration from the National Humanities Center.